Welcome to this episode of Ain't Misbehaving. This is Louisa Beale, and I have a very special guest today. My guest is Kathy Sadeo, who is an animal behaviorist who has spent 40 years as a full-time animal trainer. As part of her work toward earning a master's degree in experimental psychology, Kathy trained dolphins at the University of Hawaii's Kualoa Basin Marine Mammal Laboratory. She went on to train dolphins for the United States Department of Defense and to train whales and dolphins at the Point Defiance Zoo and Aquarium in Tacoma, Washington. Since 1998, Kathy has owned and managed Bright Spot Dog Training, which provides behavior modification services for pet owners. She used to teach about a dozen seminars annually for trainers around the world. She is an expert. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, Louisa.
It's so good to see you. It's been quite a while.
It's lovely to reconnect.
Yes. So full disclosure, I've known Kathy for a while. I can't even remember where we met.
It's got to be 25, 30 years.
Oh, it's got to be. Yeah. Because that was when Jim Haw was working with us.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Haw.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so, but besides working with Kathy, I was part of the attendees at Chicken Camp in Squim, Washington. And Kathy was one of the instructors there. And so I learned a lot from her about operant conditioning. And that's what I'd like to talk to her about today. So Kathy, I'm a convert to the clicker. What's your view?
Louisa, does your audience know what Chicken Camp refers to? I feel like that's a bit of arcane information.
It kind of is. I did talk about it on episode 3, okay. So they can go back and check. Okay. But it would be good to revisit Chicken Camp.
Yes, it would, because, that's a special little thing we did here in Squim, Washington, and I'd like people to know about it. It's ironic that you're asking me the question about all in on clicker training when I literally just this morning drove here from meeting with a new consultation client who presents to me with a adolescent labradoodle who he has showed me the photos of the bites that he's gotten from this labradoodle. So my job as an applied behaviorist is to help families whose pets have behavior problems. I mostly work with dogs, and a lot of those problems are aggression and you wouldn't think that our conversation focused a lot on the use of a clicker, but it did. Oh. And it kind of surprised Eric, the gentleman who came to see me.
So yeah.
I'm all in.
People don't realize how it can be used.
It's a silly kind of sound and device, and I think people think it's just a toy or a gadget, and the profound science behind the use of not just the clicker, it can be other marker signals, but the clicker is one we tend to use with dogs.
Such as?
Yeah.
That's a ballpoint pen.
Yes, exactly.
I've used that with dogs that are noise phobic.
And the fact that we can talk, if you'd like, about are there other options than a clicker to use as a marker signal, there certainly are. But we're going to use the word clicking or clicker right now to stand in for that ability to communicate to your, I'm going to say learner rather than animal because this works for people too. yes, people are animals, but we usually make a dividing line. But this use of a marker signal, super helpful for learning for all species in a way that can create a lot of clarity and trust and enthusiasm and everything we want in, I'm going to say the animals I work with most often are dogs. But I use the exact same training method with dolphins in all those various settings and whales and walruses and elephants and polar bears. Same training system uses a marker signal. When people embrace that to train their dogs or cats or parrots, the endless possibilities for the kind of cooperative learning you can do together. And I never get tired of it. After 40 years, I'm never tired of introducing people and their pets to the clicker. I just did it this morning and it was a blast.
Oh, I'm glad to hear you say that because, again, I'm a convert and I'm fairly evangelical about it. But, you know, the wonderful thing that people sometimes don't realize is that you are using those markers, not necessarily clicker, maybe a whistle, with the marine mammals.
Yeah.
Because you can't go out and correct them. You can't say, okay, here, I'm going to push on your tail and make you sit.
You know, it's funny that you're saying that, Louisa, because this morning I'm going to really quickly summarize a behavior case and not give away any, you know, identifying signals. But that young dog is biting because he's being coerced to be groomed in a way he's profoundly uncomfortable for. He doesn't have words. He doesn't have hands. His only way to say no is to use his mouth. And I'm here to tell you the reason he's being pushed around is he's small enough that the owner can do that. When you don't have that option, you have to be more creative. And so marine mammal trainers and other exotic animal trainers tend to use operant conditioning and positive reinforcement more often because they don't have a choice.
Right, right. And it works.
It works in a way that is so inspiring and fun that it stops training from being a chore and it makes it be this joint discovery together, which I don't know, I am all into. It is my happy place to watch learners learn, right? That's what we are as animal trainers, as good teachers. And anybody who's taught a kid or a pet understands the joy of watching them have a new skill. I don't know. It's pretty fun. But to take away that my first option is to make you do what I want, it's a nice alternate way to do some teaching without pressure.
Yeah. Which, I don't know. I mean, I don't have children, but, you know, I've been a teacher. And you can't learn under pressure. I don't care who you are. I don't care what species you are.
What you learn is to avoid.
Well, yes.
So
yes.
You learn all the ways to not be present in that situation. And then you're going to get a label as, you know, ADHD or stubborn or, you know, unfocused or, oh, you're so distractible.
Right.
It's easy to pathologize the learner rather than to go, maybe that pressure in training is, I don't know, part of the problem.
Yeah. So when you're working with clients and teaching them the clicker process, are there stumbling blocks?
Yeah, you know, it's so fresh in my mind because I literally just did this. So part of the nuance I have to bring to the conversation is this gentleman drove from Olympia and gave me money for a two-hour consultation to fix the biting. He didn't really come to learn about clicker training yet. I think this is really going to help him solve his problem. And so I have to concisely demonstrate and explain without a lot of blah, blah, how this might be a good tool for him. But there's sort of some basic rules for using a marker signal so I can get those across in words and demo without adding all the depth of science. And there's so much geekiness around operant conditioning. And Louisa, you and I can dive deep and we would love it. We would spend an evening that way.
Yes.
But lots of the folks who come to us for help aren't that interested in those geeky details. So I'm going to say to him, click once. Click with good timing to take a picture of the behavior you like. Pay after each click with a tiny bit of food. And it's click then treat, not click and treat. The sequence is really important.
I'm going to underline that because if you click and treat or if you click while you're reaching for the food overrides the sound.
And then people say, I tried that clicker thing, and what was the big deal? And it's because the dog never attended the clicker. They're too busy watching you get some food out of your bait bag or the cup on the counter. So it's really important your marker signal precedes any movement toward any payment, such as food or a toy. So that little detail makes the difference between really sloggy kind of training and, oh my gosh, we're actually making progress training.
Well, you know, I'm going to have to ask you back so we can get into the difference between the amygdala and the frontal cortex. For now, let's just talk a little bit more about the clicker. You know, let's go back in time to clicker chicken camp.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you train? I mean, I've told people this before, and it's like, How do you train a chicken?
So one of my mentors, the world-famous life-changing Karen Pryor, who passed away recently in
January, yeah.
Is a woman whose life is a testament to discovery and sharing of information and making the world better. And what an amazing woman. I was fortunate enough to learn from her and to be one of her friends. But as she would say, if your learner has a brainstem and eats, they can be trained. And that answers questions for my cat, brainstem and eats. My child, brainstem and eats. My husband, yes, even brainstem and eats. So to be able to take the science of learning and say really universal, what's interesting about training a chicken is they really can't be compelled very easily either, as can't cats. And so we say cats aren't trainable and chickens aren't trainable because you can't use your go-to method, which is I'm bigger and I can make you. Mm-hmm. So when you take that away and you go, I'd like to train my chicken to do weave pulls like you see agility dogs doing in competition on TV. Can you train a chicken to do that? It helps you be creative about, wait, I'm not going to drag them by a leash through those poles. How would I do that? One tiny step at a time, one successive approximation at a time. So the real foundation of clicker training is tiny little behaviors where your learner is successful, successful, successful. They win. They win most of the time. You've designed your curriculum so that your student is successful because the asks you make are intentionally very easy. That does not come naturally. I spent quite a bit of time with my client this morning saying, I really appreciate the video you sent me of 7 minutes of your adolescent doodle on the grooming table, avoiding, moving away, being uncomfortable, shaking off a dozen different body language signals that says he hates being on that grooming table. Before 6 minutes in, he bites you. He said no over and over and over and over, and you ignored those no's. So to say, I understand you have a goal of getting him groomed. Our first step is for me to be able to touch his shoulder for 3 seconds and count that as a win. We're going back to basics. And what is really interesting is this gentleman is a proficient musician. And he shared that with me, that he's just retired from teaching guitar lessons. And I'm like, I'm going to tell you something. I don't play a musical instrument. I have really bad memories of being a kid. Piano lessons were horrible for me. So if I come to you for lessons right now, am I going to learn to play a song in that first lesson? And he starts laughing and he's like, the first lesson, I'm going to teach you one chord and I'm going to tell you to go home and play that one chord and have fun with it. I'm like, see, I got the skill. You just don't have the skill applied to. That's where your dog is with this learning to enjoy grooming. One tiny step at a time. You'll get to playing a song, but you don't start there. And you could see him go, oh, but good dog should. I'm like, no good dog should. Let's just start with that one tiny little step. So it allows us to build some amazing things, one successive approximation at a time.
Yeah. And it seems to me that him being a musician, he should understand the importance of timing.
It's funny that you say that because that's the other really important thing about this is timing matters to all kinds of physical skills. But I could say to him, what's the difference between a magnificent song and an okay song? And he said, it's the timing behind that. I'm like, you got it.
Yeah, it's just like telling a joke.
Right, exactly.
You know, I could tell a joke right now and it would be, meh, okay. But, you know, if it was a joke about the clicker, it's all in the timing.
Timing is one of those skills you can't not include. And people usually say to me, oh, my timing is terrible with the clicker or the marker signal. I'm like, of course it is. You haven't practiced yet. We all start with it terrible. It's okay. Yeah. We're going to get better.
Because one of the things I remember in chicken class was just being outside without chickens or dogs or, you know, just the people. And I think it was you or maybe it was Morgan. I don't know. But you would throw a ball up in the air and have everybody click when the ball reached its apogee. So when it was up there hanging for that split second, click. And at first, the clicks were all over the place. But after 2 or 3 tries, we got pretty close to one click.
The only beginning student I can remember in well over 30 years of teaching pet owners clicker training skills in classes and one-on-one lessons, I still remember, I can almost remember his name. First name was Dane. And he came to a puppy training class, and his clicker training timing was way better than mine. It was so precise. Now, the irony is his puppy was a bloodhound, which you don't see very often, and they move like molasses. So you don't really need that. But I was astonished at how good his timing was. And I talked to him after class and said, how are you that good at this? Have you ever done clicker training? He said, no, but I'm a professional photographer. The exact same skill.
Ooh, exactly.
Exact same skill. Imagine taking a photo of the bat hitting the ball at a baseball game, at a Mariners game. It's the exact same thing. You have to predict when you're going to push the shutter because you know what behavior comes next. You're actually seeing a little bit ahead of time to predict the movement you're going to click.
Right, right. Wow. Well, it goes back to what you said earlier about, you know, the click is actually like taking a picture of the behavior.
It's a nice metaphor because it frees people up to just go, I just like you to use the clicker to take pictures of your dog being whatever you define as good. You don't even have to tell me. You don't have to tell the dog. You literally just have to take pictures with your clicker of moments that your dog's being an angel and then toss a treat. Interestingly, without anybody thinking too hard about it, your dog will start to do those behaviors more often all on their own. That's how their brains have evolved. Isn't that cool? Yeah. So it's kind of a fun experiment because people don't really buy in. I'm like, eh, try it. Let's see if your dog is like most of the dogs I know. And then they'll go, oh my gosh, now he's bowing all the time because I happen to click him four times when he's bowing. I'm like, isn't that cool? We have a lot of power with what we pay attention to and reinforce.
Yeah, absolutely. So another thing I remember from Chicken Camp is you demonstrating with a chicken. Well, actually, you didn't have the chicken. Somebody was working with the chicken, and they were trying to teach the chicken to spin in a circle. And so they were basically waiting too long. They were clicking and then waiting for the chicken to continue on in a circle.
Yeah.
And you stepped in and said, wait a minute, let me show you something. Can you go over that?
It's a long time ago. I'm hoping our memories coincide on this. But we're so goal-oriented when we teach something that if my learner does something correct and I click, I'm really expecting they'll do the next right thing instead of repeating the first right thing. Doing that first step over and over again. And so I'm often teaching little bits of a behavior that involves movement, focusing on just the first step of the dance before I move on, because I'm really likely to move faster than the learner is competent to be able to keep winning. I don't want the animal to win half the time. I want them to win 80 or 90% of the time so they go, this is great training with you. So it means I've got to be careful as a teacher not to ask for too much.
Well, yeah, because a lot of time it sets you up for failure.
Yeah.
Because then they don't do it and you don't click.
Right.
Yeah.
And if you're not backing your clicker up with, well, if you don't do it well, I will compel you. We're not compelling animals to do anything. Then you waste a whole lot of time and nobody's having fun, including the trainer. So I want to make sure that you're getting the reinforcement of seeing progress. And that doesn't come with big gaps of staring at your chicken staring at you, and nothing's happening.
Right. What I remember the analogy that you used. And basically, you said that when you're training a sequence, it's like exercising a muscle. You just repeat the same steps over and over and not expect them to go to the next step until they're really firm on that one.
And the other, let's add another cherry on that sundae. Science is going to suggest to us if we're training a sequence of behaviors that flow in time, A, B, C, D, we start with training D.
Oh, yeah.
Fluent. Then we add C so that when your learner does the C movement, when we ask them then to do D, they've already rehearsed that. That's really easy breezy. They know the end of the behavior chain. So we train those sequences backwards.
Yeah, and actually it's another reinforcement.
Exactly right.
Yeah.
Moving toward what you know. And so it means for speeches or musical pieces, you rehearse from the back end, not from the front end.
Yes.
You always want to
be
moving towards something you're more confident and certain about. And boy, can that speed up training of sequences of things. You know, as a freestyler, my goodness, I've seen many of your freestyle routines, and it would count for a freestyle routine. You want the end to be really strong.
Yes, exactly. And I learned a lot about training from my freestyle experience.
Yeah.
Because my dogs were just right on, perfect, all this dance moves, and mm-hmm. it was all great in the kitchen. I get out onto the competition floor, and I sent a picture once of, say, this is my dog at the last freestyle event. And the picture was of a deer in the headlights. She had no clue what I was asking.
I have great empathy for that. That is a hard thing to have an audience watching you perform.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's just my reputation, that's all. Let's see. So are there other ways and other circumstances where you might want to use the clicker?
So I'm going to use the clicker or alternate marker signals. So I sometimes say to colleagues, even though I really would like to use an actual clicker, and by the way, if somebody's listening and they've tried a clicker in dog training 15, 20 years ago, the clickers we tend to use now are much quieter. So if I get one of those old box-style clickers, it's actually really loud to me now in a way that I don't find that inviting. Mm-hmm. So for folks that are like, oh my God, not that clicker training stuff, the quieter clickers or using a ballpoint pen that you just clicked, it's not quite as loud and intrusive. So whether you're using a clicker or an alternate marker signal, I'm going to say it really excels at increasing the frequencies of voluntary movements, of muscle movements, of asking your dog. My favorite sort of general manners behavior by a long shot is something we use at Point of Mind Zoo and Aquarium a lot, which is station, which tells your animal to go move to their particular place and hang out there for a while. Boy, that's super useful if you're doing a show for the public with two walruses, three sea lions, four fur seals, and a harbor seal. And everybody else except the animal I'm working with has to be planted somewhere in that exhibit, or I'm in danger and so are the animals. So that ability to send an animal to their particular place, super useful in a zoo, but it's super useful with a pet dog. And this is very different than teaching a dog a downstay. It is teaching a magnet, often a dog bed or an armchair in your house, that the dog will readily move to when you ask them and lie down and hang out there. That to me is super useful. The clicker is really good at increasing the likelihood those movements are going to happen. And we can be really specific on what movements we want in our pet dog, in our freestyle dog, in our agility dog, in our competition obedience dog, in our guide dog. I have done a lot of work over the last few years with guide dogs for the blind because they are moving to using positive reinforcement and clickers, which is phenomenal to see this most incredibly high-end training happening without any coercion. It's fabulous. That said, if I want to change a dog's emotions about something, they're really fearful about something, I might do some alternate training that doesn't involve the clicker. It just involves some associative learning before I move on to using the clicker. So sometimes we've got to unpack some fear issues, doing some counter conditioning. But the end game for me is always some version of marker-based training, whether you're using the clicker or if I can't get you to use the clicker because you think that's icky or kludgy or... Then we're going to pick a word, and I'm going to really try to hope you pick a word that isn't in your native language, and so for in our case, isn't English, because it's super helpful you use that word not as praise, but as a actual click or beep or boop or yah, or I want you to use it with that same good timing, precision, and care that you would with an artificial noisemaker. And people do not do that with the words yes or good or what a good boy you are. That's a different thing. And we like praise, but it's not a marker signal.
Yeah, and those words, they change. They change how you say it. You know, good boy, good boy, oh, good boy. You know, it's all the same words, but it's perceived differently.
We hear those as synonyms, but for animals that don't have language, all other animals than humans, those differences in pitch and pace matter. They matter a lot. Yeah. So we want something that's consistent, right?
Yep.
Makes a big difference. So when you're choosing all these things with your new puppy or you just went to the shelter, you adopted a dog and you're making training decisions, these are important decisions. What are you going to use as a marker signal? I will say to my clients, notice I don't say to my clients, do you want to use a marker signal anymore? Because we're really going to hobble the training. I have a small business that's been successful for 30 years, partly because I have happy clients that tell other clients, and they're not happy if we don't make progress. And we're not going to make progress if we don't have some version of a marker signal. So I'll let you choose your marker signal. I'm not going to die on the hill of you must use a clicker, but I am going to say it matters that you choose one.
Yeah.
And let me show you how to use that. It's going to make a difference in how successful you are.
So are there ways that clients or people in general or listeners can misuse the clicker?
It's funny that I've run into recently two clients back to back. I don't often see this so much anymore, but two clients back to back started with a clicker training with a dog that wasn't that trusting. So in both cases, there's some suspicion in the dog. There's been some reprimands and punitive training. Let's just put it that way. So the dog is tentative in both of these cases. So both clients had this sort of epiphany that once they've used the clicker some, the dog comes to trust that signal. So they've used the clicker as a sound to get the dog to come to them when the dog is stuck in the yard and won't come in the evenings.
Oh.
So they're using it as a recall signal, not how we want to use the clicker. It will ruin using the clicker for the purposes we've been talking about, because you actually end up clicking when the dog is not coming.
Mm-hmm.
So remember, the rule is anything you click, the dog will do more often. We don't want to click the not coming dog in order to get them go, ooh, I heard the clicker, maybe there's a cookie.
Right.
Not a use for the clicker. It's not a signal to ask the dog to do something. And both those people fell into that trap. And it actually means we're throwing the clicker out as a functional tool in the long run. We're picking an alternate marker signal in both those cases because they've ruined it for the use we want it for.
Yeah, I've had some clients that, you know, almost use it like a remote control.
Yeah.
They'll point it at the dog.
Yeah. And it really can be loud in a dog's ear, and you can create an aversion in one click. You've seen that, Louisa.
Mm-hmm.
You click, especially in a herding dog's ear, one of those box clickers once, and the dog is really afraid of that sound from then on. So
right. You
don't have to point the clicker.
Yeah. And I've heard of clients from some of my colleagues were telling me that they would, you know, click and treat and click and treat, and then they would click when the dog was afraid, and the dog became fearful in that. It was almost like they poisoned the clicker.
And I don't think, so we could get into a very geeky conversation. I don't think you can increase the emotion of fear by clicking it.
Mm-hmm.
So we can get in a really rabbit hole here. I will say that if I'm working with a dog who looks really fearful, I'm probably going to save the clicker for after we've done some associative learning, some counter conditioning that's alleviated a bit of that fear, if we can manage to do that. Sometimes we're going to call in a veterinary colleague like yourself and say, well, the fear is so overriding, so pervasive, so intense possibly, that we can't get any traction with the training. Might we want to have a medication consult, because otherwise we're just spinning our wheels in the training, so that fear can overshadow the ability of the clicker to do good work. We really want a comfortable, confident learner when we're clicker training, and so that's kind of a prerequisite.
Yeah, I'm glad to hear you say that. I love drugs.
And we love having a veterinarian who can do skilled consulting on that, so...
Yeah, well, talk to me 5 years ago.
Yeah. Yes, and I did. I pressured you. You worked longer than you wanted, because I'm like, please, Louisa, just one more case.
Oh, anything for you, Kat.
But we love our veterinary colleagues, our veterinary behaviorists, to help us make decisions about how we can get good behavior change, not just through training, but all the tools we have.
Exactly, exactly. Well, cool. So is there anything you'd like to add? I know that you have lectured at Clicker Expo for a number of years.
43 Clicker Expos.
Yeah. And one, you know, you're really good at titles. And
I like my titles.
You do. And my favorite one is Candy is Dandy, but Clicker is Quicker.
You'll like one. I did at Clicker Expo a few years ago, because I'm someone who loves Dogs who are muzzle trained, comfortable, well-fitting basket muzzles, gosh, they're a kindness to train bad dogs. No, every dog benefits from being able to comfortably wear a well-fitted muzzle. Let's promote and celebrate it. And I titled that workshop Muzzle Tov. I was pretty proud of that.
That was very good. Very good.
Yes, I like my pithy titles.
Yes. Well, you wrote a book called Plenty in Life is Free.
I did.
Reflections on dogs training and finding grace. And in here, I highly recommend the book. It is just a font of information and very entertaining. And one of my, you have titles for each of the chapters. And one of my favorite one is Putting the Heart Before the Force.
See, I like someone who appreciates a good pun, and I'm and the book was has been translated in a couple of different languages. I'm like, how does that work?
Oh, yeah. So how would you do that?
I don't know, but I don't read Czech, so yeah. Do you know what I mean? I don't. Is it a good translation? I don't know. I trust who's ever doing that. And you are actually featured in that book I wrote a while back, as you helped me have a great epiphany about my own dog's aggression that has forever been a teaching moment for me about the ways our stories can confuse us about what the function of aggressive behavior is. And it really needs someone who's sensitive to the ways, especially dogs, are perceiving signals in their environment that could be threatening. And I missed a signal in my own dog that Louisa was genius enough to be able to help me suss out, and it changed my life with my dog Nick, who had a biting history, and Louisa helped me fix that in a kind of a fun way because his trigger was one that never crossed my mind.
Well, I don't know if you should say how in tune I was with that trigger.
Now we have to reveal that.
I suppose we do. Do you tell the situation?
Can I?
Yes.
Okay. So Nick, a mixed medium-sized herding breed mutt, came to me in an unusual way. I did an assessment for the trainers at the local women's prison, Purdy Women's Prison, who correctional facility, who train service dogs. And so they had taken this dog, whose name at the time was Ducky. They had taken Ducky from the shelter to be a service dog in training at the prison with the inmates who were part of that program. And this was a longstanding program, and Ducky bit one of the guards. And so they called me in to do an assessment, not to ask if this could be a service dog, clearly it's not, but should he be euthanized or should they try to rehome him? So it was many years ago, and I was fool enough to not only assess him as stressed out beyond belief. He was literally bouncing off the walls. That's not a euphemism. He was in a kennel run, spinning and flinging himself against the walls. He was really uncomfortable in that busy, noisy environment. And I said I thought he would probably be remediable in another environment. And I was foolish enough to say that environment would be my home. So I adopted him and then learned a ton. But here was the surprise to me. I knew he would be uncomfortable around men. He bit a male guard, and he was really afraid of men. There was no mystery to that, and I could do some training around that. And I felt very cocky that I got to the point where if he saw an unfamiliar man approach him, he would drool with excitement because I had paired that with a whole lot of steak, and he figured out that the appearance of men was not a threat. I am proud. I'm patting myself on the back. And he proceeded to bite two of my female friends different evenings, both at my house, both on the foot. But first time was a fluke. Second time was he knows these people. He's comfortable with them. I have no idea what's going on. Fortunately, the bites were not injurious, but they were very upsetting to me and everybody else. And I got some training advice from one colleague that didn't sit so comfortably with me. And I was kind of kvetching to Louisa about it. And I asked her, please, I think I'm missing something. I'm too close to the situation. I really love this dog. I've made so much progress. Why could he possibly be biting Kelly and Nancy in my house? And Louisa had the insight to say, had they had a drink? And each of my friends had had a glass of wine. They were not drunk, but they had gone from people who did not smell like liquor to people who did smell like liquor. And Nick was originally a street dog in Yakima. And what's his experience of people who have had drinks? Possibly not good.
Yeah, drunken man, my God.
Can he smell alcohol in someone? Oh my gosh, a mile away. It's such an obvious signal to him. I don't smell a glass of wine on someone's body. So I wasn't even aware that something had changed for Nick. And he bit both of their feet, which I thought was interesting. So I can make up a story. I don't know if it's true. But the fact that he maybe had a bad incident with someone who smelled like alcohol being kicked, he still had a problem with that. So I had never had the insight to normalize his behavior as the reaction of someone who's had some trauma and create a training program that got him comfortable with people that had drinks, which meant friends had to come over and have a glass of wine and pitch some treats to Nick and let him be more comfortable around that. And we proceeded successfully to get him comfortable with that. But I was blind until Louisa asked me the right questions. Yeah. She's a good behaviorist.
Yeah, you just have to have enough wine to think about that.
I use that as a learning example now to be able to go, we are constantly identifying what the dog might be upset about that they can see and hear, because we can see and hear it. And I think a huge proportion of the time they're smelling something and they're hearing things out of our pitch that we can hear. And we say, out of the blue, the dog, not out of the blue, just out of our perceptual range. And I think animals don't lie. If they're upset, they're upset for a reason.
Yeah, I read a book by Alexandra Horowitz.
Oh, I like her a lot.
Called Being a Dog. Yeah. And she talks about the sense of smell, and it's incredible.
She's a wonderful writer. I like her books a lot.
Yeah.
A cognitive scientist specializing in dog learning and a good writer. But it makes you tune in to go, oh, I'm not even aware what the world, how you experience the world and what might be bothersome to you, right?
So it's opening our eyes to our, you know, canine and feline friends about what their perceptions are and how they respond to us.
And our nose.
Yeah. Yes, yes.
Yeah, that whole behavior has a function, even behaviors we don't like. It's meeting a need for your learner is a pretty open-minded kind of, curious way to look at what we call misbehavior and to say, it's misbehavior in our eyes because it's rude or dangerous, but it's serving a function in the animal.
Well, that's why I call this program Ain't Misbehaving. They're just behaving.
See, I like that title. Someone who likes titles.
Yeah. Well, actually, I learned that from Bob Bailey. They wrote The Misbehavior of Animals about raccoons, but it was kind of a tongue-in-cheek because B.F. Skinner said the animals don't misbehave. That's what I keep saying when there are problems that arise, and they are basically our problems.
We ask a lot of dogs, and it's interesting to me that for many people, the first species they train are dogs, and there is no species more sensitive to our own emotions than dogs. And it's really a complication that our learners need us to be emotionally stable and secure, and very often the behavior problems make us anxious. It's an interesting thing that we have these very sensitive learners with us. And yet, a client this morning said to me, I'm going to be really honest, said to me, but I've only used the shock collar on him 3 times. And that came up an hour into our conversation with a dog who's presenting to me quite anxious in my presence in a silly fooling around kind of way. The dog couldn't settle. He's really frantic and jumping and moving. And an hour in, said to me, but only 3 times. And I try to not, I'm not going to shame my client. I'm glad he's here. But you can't say just 3 times with something so powerful as a shock collar. And so moving forward, I want to say, really hope we can put that tool aside because it's creating some of the problems you're seeing, even though in the moment you did that, the dog came. The price you paid for that recall out of your yard in the moment because your son told you all good trainers use shock collars, you're paying for it now, a year later. So to be able to have sort of that long-range view of, I don't want to create that distrust and suspicion that's going to hobble our training and our progress from then on because it seemed expedient. I think we want to be really honest about conversations about the side effects of those very commonly used tools here in the United States, not in all countries. They're illegal in many countries.
Yeah. So, we're going to have another conversation, including negative reinforcement, which is so misunderstood.
Mm-hmm.
But I think I'm going to leave it there for now. This has been wonderful. So I have enjoyed this so much, and it's so good to see you.
It's good to see you, too. And, boy, we go back a lot in that we're still interested in this topic and wanting to help spark other people's interest. We got a fun job to do in that once you pick up a clicker and you do a little experimenting, you watch a good YouTube video and you say, I'm just going to try that. I'm going to see an experiment. See if it catches fire for you. You might have more fun than you've ever had with your dog.
I know I did. Well, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Again, my guest has been Kathy Sadeo, the author of Plenty in Life is Free and an animal behaviorist for over 40 years.
Here in Tacoma, my website is my name, kathysadeo.com. If you're interested in a behavior consultation, you can find out more information there.
Perfect. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.